This morning we have the privilege of hearing from one of our teachers in the yeshiva, Rav Aaron Kahn. And as Rav Kahn sometimes mentions, he's probably the youngest Holocaust survivor. He was born in Nazi-occupied Europe at the end of the war and came here with his family to the United States, and he's been a part of our yeshiva, I believe, for 50 years.
That's right.
Rav Kahn came, he was a student of the great Rav Soloveitchik, who was such a powerful influence in our yeshiva. Rav Kahn was the primary reviewer for Rav Soloveitchik's shir for an entire decade, for 10 years. We would review the Rav's shir, and it's really a tremendous privilege for us that Rav Kahn agreed to make time to speak to us, to give us words of inspiration. And I can say that Rav Kahn, I know, hardly ever sleeps. He's always busy helping other Jews. The great founder of yeshivos was Rav Chaim of Volozhin. He was the great student of the Gaon of Vilna. He lived in the early 19th century. Chaim of Volozhin's son, Rav Itzel, writes in the introduction to Rav Chaim's book, Nefesh HaChaim, that his father was always busy because he was trying to help people. He would have people who were depressed around him, and he would give them words of encouragement. There's a famous story that Rav Chaim of Volozhin, initially when he started the yeshiva, took money out of his own pocket to buy the clothing for the boys of the yeshiva. When it was time before a big winter, he went and he bought big boots. And they asked him, why do you need these boots? He said, you'll see. There was one day there was a terrible snowstorm, and they found 5 o'clock in the morning Rav Chaim of Volozhin was jumping in the snow. They asked him, what are you doing? That I'm making a path for the boys from the yeshiva that they can walk to the yeshiva and not have to walk through snow. Because Rav Itzel of Volozhin writes about his father, that his father taught him that a person lives lahoil la'acherim, to help others. And he should dedicate all of his energy to help others. And that is something that Rabbi Kahn exemplifies. He hardly sleeps because you can't even imagine how many people he is carrying with counseling, with advice, with help. So, of course, I inconvenienced him further and asked him to come and give us his heart and his time. And I, as always, ask of him that if there are students who would like to spend time with Rav Kahn, that they can. You can find him on the streets. You can go for coffee with him, talk to him, take from him, draw from his wisdom, because I'm sure you'll be enriched from it, just as I have been, and many of your teachers have been as well. So, b'chavod, Rav Kahn. I was asked to speak about how to keep the fires burning, how to maintain our enthusiasm, the excitement, the wonder of the Yomim Noroim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkos. And, you know, many times when I'm asked to give a shiur, so even if I know the topic very well and I've given a shiur many, many times, I try to follow Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha's very wise, very sage recommendation to everyone who gives a shiur, that you have to prepare and prepare well. On occasion, my preparation requires hours and hours in front of Sfarim. On occasion, the preparation is sufficient if on my way to yeshiva while I'm driving, I think about what it is that I want to say. And on occasion, on rare occasion, I decide not to prepare at all, because that's the preparation. What do I mean? Something that comes from the heart, something that comes from your instincts, from your intuitions, is very often cramped and stifled
by the preparation. Every time you come with a pat answer, when you come with an idea that you've already anticipated, thought it out, you fleshed it out, it comes in a box with a ribbon. And the heart never comes in a box with a ribbon. The heart is spontaneous. The heart is natural. The heart is who you are already. So the preparation for that kind of a drasha, that kind of a speech, is your life. Not what you can find in a sefer in an hour or two or even 10. And that's really how I would like to approach you today. And I couldn't have found a better segue opportunity than what we just heard from Rav Reichman, Shlita. Because I think that the biggest element, the most significant ma'akev, what holds you back from simcha, from enthusiasm, from joie de vivre, you know, this excitement about life itself, is a very obsessive preoccupation with our own needs. The moment we go beyond who we are, and the moment we stop thinking so much about ourselves, even in sacred matters, it is dafka then that one begins to live and to breathe. A person was created so that he should be in the image of Hashem. And being in the image of Hashem means that you have to concern yourself and be mated, provide, do good, care. And all of those instincts that a person has for others allows his neshama to breathe. And when your neshama breathes, you are happy. There is a remarkable consequence to this. I always wondered, when I was younger and I was beginning to enter into my rabbinic role, my pastoral role, they call it a pastoral role. What's pastor? What is a pastor? A shepherd, correct. In many languages, that word means a shepherd. The pastoral role, you're a shepherd. Son kadoshim. You are a shepherd of a holy flock. The holy flock doesn't have to have thousands of members. On the contrary, no individual can take care of thousands of people. Then it becomes a drasha. Then it becomes a pat box with a ribbon around it. But if you really care, you care about Reuven and Shimon and Levi, and maybe there's not even time for anybody else. When I was beginning that role or that part of my life, I had a tremendous fear. What was my fear? My fear was, how many tzaras, how much suffering can an individual hear before he begins to crack under the strain? So the answer that everybody would give you is that there's a way of becoming objective and transcendent, and then you don't have that pain because you've pushed it aside. You keep your distance in order to give your advice, in order to help, in order to provide. You have to keep a distance. Now that may be very, very good advice for a doctor. A doctor who's busy doing a surgery and needs a precise and very laser-like focus cannot start worrying about what this person is all about and how important it is for them to live and how much their family cares. You can't think like that and do your job. It might even be appropriate for a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a social worker. But never, ever imagine that this is the proper way for a rav. Because a rav who is objective and pushes the element of compassion aside is worthless. Because he's become a social worker. And a rav may be part social worker, part psychiatrist, part psychologist, part friend, part anything. But is much more. And the reason he's more is because he takes for himself a very special role in imitation of Hashem. Rachmana liba bo'i. Hashem needs the heart. He doesn't need the heart just to do mitzvahs or to daven with kavana. He needs the heart that beats with compassion for the other person. So I was thinking to myself at the time that this is such a formidable task. It's such an unbelievably demanding and impossible task. How can I carry so many tzaras in my heart? If I can't objectify and I can't push it aside, how will it ever be possible for me to manage this person's divorce and that person's losing a child to some horrible disease, and this person's losing his job, and this person worrying about when he'll ever find a shidduch for his daughter, and on and on and on. And if you have that compassion, it's a searing compassion. It's not, no, don't let anyone ever delude you into thinking that the Rav has the same feeling as the parent of that daughter who didn't get the shidduch. Because that's not possible. It's humanly not possible to be so compassionate that you take over the role and you become the heart of the father or the mother, or the heart of the parent that lost the child, Rachmana Litzlan, Bar Minan. That will never happen. That's a delusion. But to the extent that any human being is capable of hearing somebody else's pain, how can you carry that burden? And you know what I discovered? I discovered a number of things. First thing I discovered is that the human heart has almost infinite capacity. You know, you can lift up a brick, you can lift up 10 bricks. If you're really a strong fellow, you can lift up 30 or 40 bricks. That's it. That's the load. There's something remarkable about the heart. If you care enough, the heart expands. It really expands. And one never knows how much he can carry because the heart keeps expanding and it seems to be almost infinite. That's the first thing that I learned. The second thing that I learned is even more remarkable, a lesson than the first. And that's what is important for us today. The second thing that I learned is that not only is it possible to bear, it is a source of incredible joy. It's not the joy of the other person's tzara, obviously. When you hear the suffering, you are seared with an incredible sense of pain. And compassion has to be painful, because otherwise there is no compassion. But I'm not talking about that moment. I'm talking about one's life. In other words, how is your day? My Rebbetzin will ask me at 2 o'clock in the morning. How was your day? And how do I answer that? So I can give her a list, a litany of all of the things that I had to deal with and had to take care of or had to try to help. And the list, and she gives me her list. And her list is sometimes longer and more complicated and more demanding than mine. But if you ask me the same question, but you don't mean what did I do, but what am I? How do I feel about myself? I would almost say, who am I at this moment? And the answer is the happiest person on earth. And this is every single day. And that's why someone once asked me, why am I smiling in the middle of Shmona Esrei? And I think what he was thinking was, Mistama, I'm thinking about something outside of the davening. It's kind of like he wanted to see, you know, if he could get me to admit that I really wasn't having kavana. You know, the great Rabbi Kahn not having kavana, that's not nice. And I told him, I don't understand, how come you don't smile? So he says, what do you mean? So I said, you say, modim anachnu loch. Al nisecha shebechol yom imanu v'al niflosecha v'tovosecha shebechol eis ervav. I asked him, do you say that? You say modim? He says, yeah, of course I say modim. Everybody says modim. Every single Shmona Esrei, day in, day out, 365 days a year, has modim. And you say to Hashem, thank you, Hashem, for all the miracles that you have performed for me. Erev vokev etzarayim, myriads of miracles. Now, I'll tell you, I tell this fellow, I don't know about you, but, you know, this guy just came out of the mine in Chile. I mean, it happened long ago, but I'm just using that as an analogy. I think he's pretty grateful. How long were they there?
69 days.
33 people or whatever it is, cooped up for 69 days in this hole in the ground, and never being 100% confident until the last moment when they get out upon Mother Earth that they are ever going to survive this episode or ever see with their own eyes, at least, their loved ones again. Now, is there gratitude or is there no gratitude? Unbelievable gratitude. Well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does that for us every single day. We don't know about it. We don't appreciate it because we don't know about it. And that's why Chazal insisted that we should acknowledge it, and they put it into the Shemona Esrei day and night, three times a day, all year long. And in Musaf also. Because Hashem works His miracles without asking for credit and without fanfare and without making explosions and firecrackers and fireworks does not mean in the least that we should limit our gratitude. Well, if you acknowledge that these miracles are occurring, how come you're not smiling? And he had no answer for me. The same thing is true here. The opportunity to help another Jew is the greatest gift that anybody could possibly have gotten. And this isn't something that you just say. It is the greatest gift that you could possibly have received. And it is the ultimate source of simcha. Since I am a Rav and a Rosh Yeshiva, I have to quote a Rambam. I can't help it. So you'll forgive me. The Rambam has the laws of Purim. Before you know it, it's around the corner. Everybody knows what Purim requires. I'm not talking about Shivas Regal. I'm talking about what Purim requires. Now everybody knows what Purim requires. So there's a mitzvah of reading the Megillah. There's a mitzvah of Seudas Purim, with the Shivas Regal, Enochanami. And there's a mitzvah of Matonos Levyonim, and a mitzvah of Mishloach Monos. Right? Everybody knows. You give something to your acquaintances, to your friends, and you also give gifts to the poor. Matonos l'avyonim. What is the minimum requirement on Purim day to give gifts to the poor? What does it mean, gifts to the poor? So the answer is, matonos l'avyonim, you give a gift to one ani, you give a gift to a second ani, you have fulfilled the mitzvah. In this Rambam, he gives you the secret of life. I mean, most people learn this Rambam, they wouldn't acknowledge what I just said. They'd say, what are you talking about? It's just another Rambam. I'm telling you, it's the secret of life itself, certainly the life of a Jew. The Rambam says, mitzvah laharbos b'matonos l'avyonim. If you have money in your pocket and you want to do the mitzvah again and again, you could. Certain mitzvahs you can't fulfill twice or three times. You do it and it's done. But certain mitzvahs is kol hamarba hareze meshubach, like we say in the Haggadah. The more the merrier, the more the better. So the Rambam says, well, now you have a whole bunch of mitzvahs here. What should you emphasize? So he says, better give to the poor than to do any of the other mitzvahs. So we would have said, the reason is simple. Because if you give to the poor, not only do you have the mitzvah of Purim, but you also have the mitzvah of tzedakah, which is an unbelievable mitzvah. Whereas in the others, all you have is that mitzvah. Suda's Purim. Suda is Suda. It's one Suda. You have a big Suda, you have a smaller Suda, you eat more, you eat less, you drink more, you drink less. Okay. But tzedakah, but that's not what the Rambam says. And without quoting the Rambam verbatim, because that's not necessary, I'm going to paraphrase the Rambam. The Rambam says, because the main and essential feature of Purim is to be Sameach. And there is no greater simcha than to be Mesameach, to make joyous the hearts of the unfortunate, the miserable. To bring joy into their lives by connecting to them and by providing for them. There is no greater joy. And the Rambam, as if to explain, why do you say that? Why do you say that there's no greater joy? He says, because a person who's mesameach is dome l'shchina. He is like Hashem himself.
where it is written concerning Hashem, Lahachyos, to bring the miserable back to life, to take the oppressed and those who suffer and those who don't have, and to care for them. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's business. When you do that, you're like the Shekhinah. So when I learned this Rambam the first time, the 10th time, and the 50th time, I asked myself, wait a minute, there's a non sequitur over here. It doesn't follow. The Rambam is telling me there's no greater simcha. And then he says, because, as if to explain why there's no greater simcha, because you are like the Shekhinah, because the Shekhinah also provides. So wait a minute. I know that I'm like the Shekhinah because I'm supposed to imitate Hashem and this is what Hashem does. But how does that connect to there's no greater simcha? You know what the answer is? Because the more you like the Shekhinah, the more you fulfill yourself. And the more the Neshama breathes, its identity and its essence being fulfilled, there is no greater source of joy in the world. That is the secret of life. The secret of life, therefore, is that the more we are like Hashem, you can daven to Hashem, you can ask Hashem, and you can be busy with yourself 24/7. You'll never be happy. Never. It's impossible. Because the secret of happiness is to be like Hashem. Not to serve Hashem, but to be like Hashem. And the only way we as human beings can be doyme l'shchina is by caring for others. Because the whole Olam Chesed Yibona, the whole world was created for that possibility of caring. Memela, that Rambam, even though it's buried somewhere in Hilchos Megillah, at the end of Sefer Zmanim, is really the secret weapon of every Jew. How do you survive a Holocaust? To speak about Holocaust survivors, I may very well be the youngest Holocaust survivor, because I was born literally a few days before the war was over. You can make the calculation of how old I am later. But the bottom line is that the Holocaust surviving Jew built and created and built and created and built and created. It's unbelievable. There's no other people on earth that has the capacity to rise out of the ashes like the proverbial phoenix and just reconstitute himself. I mean, you create a state of Israel, and the state of Israel is, I don't know, it's just an unbelievable phenomenon of creativity, of rebuilding. You take an arid, barren wasteland, and you make of it an oasis in the desert. You take an economy that is the envy of the entire world. You have tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of immigrants from Russia, and all of a sudden, you have the largest, next to the United States, number of NASDAQ corporations, startups. I mean, it's mind-boggling. At Entira, Lahavdil, it's mind-boggling the amount of Sfarim that come out. If I had a photographic memory and if I had a speed reading ability, I don't think I could manage, if I just spent all day looking at Sfarim, to contain all the Sfarim that come out day after day after day in every aspect of Torah. Nigla, Nistar, Halacha, Medrash, Agoda, anything you want, Lamdas. Where does that creativity come from? How does a Holocaust survivor and a person that's constantly oppressed and thousands of years of suffering, murder, mayhem, rape, how do you manage to manage a life in that context and build and create? You know what the answer is? So you'll go to some social psychologist and maybe they'll give you other answers. But I know what the answer is. The answer is because Yiddishkeit is built on caring for the other. The parents came and they had little babies, or they dreamed about having babies, and they got married and they built a family. And when you're building a family, that's all you're doing the whole day, is caring for others. And that gives you the energy. So if you're asking me, what can I do after Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? You know, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, for all that it is, could very well be an extremely selfish activity. Now, we try our best, and Klal Yisrael has an Anshei Knesset HaGedolah who formulated the words of these tefillos, and they were extraordinarily big people. And they help us. You know how they help us? First of all of the language is in the plural. You never ask for yourself alone. That's very important. Hashiveinu and Refa'einu and Barecha Leinu, it's all
us, not me. In fact, take the bracha for refuah. In the Navi, because they took the words of the Navi, mostly from Tehillim, but very often from the Navi, and the pasuk says, "Rifa'eini Hashem ve'erafei hashi'eini ve'iva sheya," all in the singular. Heal me, Hashem. Save me, Hashem. What did Anshei Knesset HaGdola do? They took the exact language, but they turned it just the same from the singular to the plural. Rifa'enu Hashem v'neirafei hoshi'enu v'nivashaya. Any of us that's learning Hebrew on that level, so it's a very good example. Take this and turn it into the plural. It's not I, it's we. That's one of the secret weapons that Chazal introduced in our tefillos so that we don't become too selfish. And then there's another thing. There's a constant awareness that we are part of a Klal Yisrael, and that our concerns transcend any individual. So right after refuah, we ask for parnasa, but we're talking about Eretz Yisrael, we're talking about Geula, we're talking about Yerushalayim. Belongs to everybody. Yerushalayim lo nischalka l'shvatim. That kind of flow from needs that are mine, where I include everybody, to needs that are to begin with, not mine specifically, is also meant to remind me that I am not an island unto myself. But with all of that, it could still remain an extremely selfish activity. Learning can be an extremely selfish, self-centered activity. Very remarkable that the Gemara says on the pasuk in Eishes Chayil, "V'soras Chesed al Lishona." She speaks the language of Torah's Chesed, of a Torah of generosity, of loving kindness, Chesed. So, what is a Torah shel Chesed, and what is a Torah that doesn't have Chesed? What does Torah have to do with Chesed? Torah is learning. So you speak about an Eishes Chayil, you understand, but that's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says there is a Torah of Chesed and there's a Torah that's without Chesed. Torah of Chesed is when you teach others. Torah can be an extremely selfish activity. I have to know all of this. I have to become a Talmud Chacham. And by the way, you do. You really do have to know all of it. That's the commandment. But before you know it, you can be so absorbed in what you need to be and what you need to know. And it's the same thing with even striving for greater heights in Yirah Shamayim. There's a Rabbi Grossman who's in Migdal HaEmek. Probably before any of you were born, he came here to the yeshiva one Shabbos. It's a very long time ago. I would say about 30 years ago. So some of you weren't born yet. And he said something very beautiful. He told over a mashal, which is very much to the point. He said that, tells a story to explain the words that we say in Uvol Tzion Goel. Baruch Hu Elokeinu Shebira Anu L'chvodo V'Yivdilonu Min HaTovim, etc. Blessed is Hashem who created us to do Him honor. So he tells the story of two brothers that were informed by their father who lived here in America, and the brothers were living in Eretz Yisrael, that there's a great simcha in the family. The youngest child, the youngest brother, is getting married, or youngest sister, whatever it was, is getting married. Now, this father was himself rather substantial. In Eretz Yisrael, the two brothers had very opposite circumstances. One of them was very rich, and the other one didn't have a penny to his name. But he sent them both an invitation with a letter attached. And the letter said that, "I know that I'm asking much of you to stop your lives and come to America and spend a couple of weeks here to share in my simcha in your sibling's wedding. But I want you to know that at least time I can't compensate you for, but at least any expense that you incur, whatever it is, to do me honor, I will repay you, I will reimburse you to the last cent." Well, the rich brother was very, very excited because Mishi Yesh Lo Mana wrote some asayim, and even though he certainly could have afforded it, he didn't mind having some extra money. As Chazal say, whoever has a dollar wants another dollar, and according to the Vilna Gaon, the pshat is he wants $2 besides the dollar. I think the Gaon had greater insight into the human nature. It breeds an appetite, money. You have money, it's never enough, and you always want more. So he decided, with such an offer, how can you go wrong? He went to the luggage store and he bought the fanciest suitcases money could buy. They bought dresses for the wives and the daughters and suits, brand new suits. He had a beautiful suit. He bought another suit anyhow, a fancy tuxedo. And on and on and on. And of course, first class tickets. What's the question? If the father's going to pay, first class, nothing but the best. The poor fellow, having been left to his own devices and having absolutely nothing, went to a local gemach. You know what that is? He borrowed money from a free loan fund. And he just barely, you know, he ferreted out some suitcases that were torn and tattered. And one wheel was off and then one handle was broken. But it worked. They managed. And they took all their shmatis, all their old clothes, and, you know, they tried to fix it up. They took it to a tailor, asked them to do them a favor. They're going to America to a wedding, and on and on and on. And finally, of course, obviously, they had to buy tickets. But not having any money, they bought the minimum, and of course, they couldn't buy first class. And they waited and hoped that at least that would be reimbursed for them. Well, they send a message that they're coming on this and this flight to America on this and this day. And the father is so excited that his children are coming, and he's so excited about presenting them to the new mechutin. You know what mechutin means? You know, the other side, the parents. And he drags them to the airport. And he says, I want to show you the rest of my family. And, of course, first class comes out first. So first class comes out first. They come out. The luggage was sparkling. And it's gorgeous. These people in fanciest clothes, and they're coming out. And it's mamish unbelievable. And the father is beaming. He says, you see, this is my son so-and-so, and look at his family, gorgeous, beautiful people. And then, where are the rest of them? Where are the other 15 members of the family? Like Carl Sandburg said, the rich get richer and the poor have children. What is with them? Well, the first class comes out first, you have to wait. And they wait an interminable amount of time. And finally, these schleppers come out, one looking more ragged than the other. It's like maybe even those miners looked better than they did. And the father takes one look at them, and he says to the mechutin, these are also my children. And there's a tremendous lump in his throat and a very big ache in his heart that he has to acknowledge that these are his children. Take a look at them. Anyhow, the wedding proceeded, and during the time, of course, the rich family put themselves in the fanciest hotel, you know, the Waldorf Astoria or whatever it was, and naturally in the penthouse suite, and it racked up a $5,000 a day bill, and so on and so forth. Of course, the father's going to pay, and he certainly can afford it. And the others, you know, they didn't have any money, so the father's going to pay fine. So they're going to put it on the credit card. They have no credit card. So they found themselves some friend to stay with or whatever. And that's how they had the chasana and the sheva brachas. Comes time to go home. So the son that didn't have anything, he didn't have much of a bill, and he sent the bill to the father, and the father sent him back, you know, gave him all the money. The rich son also sent him a bill, and he's waiting and waiting and waiting, and nothing's happening. Finally, he can't take it any longer. He's about to get on the plane. He calls up his father. He says, Dad, you know, you sent us a letter. He said, I sent you a letter? That what? He said, don't you remember? You said you would compensate us for everything that we spent for the wedding. And it's come out to about $100,000. So the father said, I don't remember ever saying anything like that. He said, the fellow's face went white. He says, what are you talking about? I have the letter in my pocket. He says, you have the letter? Why don't you show it to me? So he runs over to his father's office, opens up the letter, hands him the letter. There it is, black on white. So the father reads the letter out loud. He says, whatever you do to give me honor, I will
compensate you for every sin.
He said to him, you gave me honor? If you were due to give me honor in Eretz Yisrael, you would have seen to it that when you buy that luggage, you buy him the luggage also. And when you take first class tickets, you buy him first class tickets also. And you make sure that he looks like the epitome of what I want my mechutin to see and what I want them to look like. You selfish good for nothing. All you cared about is what you could squeeze out of me. I am not giving you a penny. That was Rav Grossman's story. And he said that we say every day in Uvolat Tzion, Baruch Hu Elokeinu, blessed is our God, who created us, Sheb Bira Anu, Lichvodo, to do him honor. And then you go about your business and you want to be the best Jew you can possibly be, and you do the most wonderful things, and you eat Glatt Kosher and Chol of Yisrael, and you make sure that your menorah is this high and made of beautiful silver, and on and on and on. And you buy a Sefer Torah and you dedicate it to the shul. What did you do in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's honor if you didn't care about the other Jew who is not yet from, who is, doesn't have any money, who doesn't know about Yiddishkeit, who needs you because he's suffering and he has a tzara? Nothing. You're not living in my honor. You're living a selfish life. You want Gan Eden, you want Olam Haba, you want Kavod, but you're not living in my honor. Shebra Anu, he created us to do him honor. So that brings us full circle, and I'll never forget that. It made a very big impact even on me. The purpose of a Jew ultimately is to be Domeh to Hashem. And you know how you are Domeh to Hashem? You're Domeh to Hashem when you care about others. But I started with something, and I think it's very important. You know, you reach a certain age when you really want that whatever you say makes a difference, because you don't have that much time left. So you want to make an impact. You want somebody to change because of what you say. All right, that's a lot to ask. But I started by saying that it's the only true and relevant source of joy. A lot of people walking around in a fog, and a lot of people are not happy. It's not a happy time. Because the secret of being happy is to shed some of those thoughts of preoccupation with myself and start replacing them with preoccupations. Preoccupations, not just thoughts, but real preoccupations. It bothers me. I'm busy with it. You know, sometimes you have a shadchan, and sometimes you have a person that's not a professional shadchan. So you call up that person because they know someone who knows someone, and they can maybe reach out and find a shidduch for my daughter. So I call that person up. All my children are married. I'm speaking my daughter, anybody's daughter. I call up somebody, and I say, you know, maybe you can help me. So I don't know. I'm very busy. It's a big responsibility. You know, I heard some horror stories, and shadchanim never, you always get kicked in the teeth by both sides. So just do me a favor, just make the call. All right. The person thinks he's doing them the favor of the century, and he takes the phone number. Okay? They call up. The phone is busy. Thank God. You know what that is? The rich guy in the story that Rabbi Grossman told. And then there's another kind of person. My Rebbetzin happens to be that kind of a person. I don't mind saying so. The phone is busy, you call again. You call again and again and again till you get through. And then the person says, I don't know, somebody else suggested it. Maybe I'll think about it, maybe I won't. But in any case, he's busy right now. The other person says, thank God. My Rebbetzin says, when can I call you? I don't know. We'll find out in a week or two if it's relevant. 2 weeks later, and without a Palm Pilot, without a BlackBerry, the call is being made already. You know what that requires? That requires one thing. Maybe it requires a very good memory. Maybe it requires a very good head. Maybe it requires something else, though. That girl became your daughter for a while. that those heartaches, that twisting in the stomach at night when you wonder, is she ever going to find a shidduch, becomes your problem. And nothing will stand in your way. Doesn't mean the shidduch will happen. That's up to Hashem. But nothing will stand in your way to try to make it happen, because it became your inyan, your issue, your problem, your worry, your concern. And when that happens, you are doma l'shchina. And that's the answer of how you can survive. The way a Rav survives, full circle to what I started out with, is not by becoming dispassionate. The way a Rav survives is not by not caring that much so that he can do his job. Because the Rav's job, unlike all of the others that I described, the main part of the job is caring. So you know what happens? You cave in? Never! Because it creates in you such an unbelievable, you can call it fulfillment. It's almost obscene to call it fulfillment, because it's so much more than that. Fulfillment is also selfish. You become daima l'shchina. You can't even describe what happens. But at that level and in that way, there is nothing but light and nothing but joy. It's the way it is. And I wish I had a way of proving it to you, of conveying that to you. And only, the only way, you'd have to crawl into my skin, into my heart. That's not possible. But the fact is that the whole of Yiddishkeit is coming to teach this lesson in the final analysis. All the rest, as they say, is commentary. All the mitzvahs and everything that a Jew does and everything that Hashem wants of him and everything that Hashem told Avraham Avinu. You see it by Avraham Avinu. V'avarchem avarachecha v'heyei brachem. Midas ha-chesed. There are three of us. Why do you start with Midas HaChesed? You know why? Because without Midas HaChesed, it doesn't even get off the ground. Avram is the Ribbono Shlom's extension. He just takes it to the human level. Ein lecha simcha mefo'ara ela l'sameach umlolim ve'avyonim. Sheham esameach doima l'shchina. Shenema lahach yois ruach shvalim. So I hope that we're able to translate some of that into lamaisa, into the doing of it. Students are maybe the most selfish of all, because they're constantly busy with themselves in a good way. There's nothing nasty about it. There's nothing wrong about it per se. But you have an agenda. You have your schedule. You have your tests and your finals and your midterms and your papers and your lab work and your classes and even your lacrosse or your basketball or your baseball or your chess or your fencing and on. Or your night seder. But it's me and me and me and me. And in all of that, you're gonna have to figure out how to make it not so much me, and make it somebody else. And somebody else also, maybe somebody else even more than also. And when that happens, I promise and guarantee you, you will have found the elixir of happiness. The magic elixir. The magic potion. And you will, of course, come and thank me for it. Without a doubt. Should have tremendous hatzlacha. What time is it? I forgot to go get my shiur. Yeah, perfect. So you should have tremendous hatzlacha. I give you, besides being a rav and a rosh yeshiva of sorts, I give you something that I am for sure, and that is a kohen. I give you a birchas kohen, that you should be able to integrate, as they say, these kind of lessons. And I have to tell you, I've been here a very long time, and no one asked me to say this, you understand. But I'm saying it because I believe it and I feel it. Never has the yeshiva assembled a staff of caring rebbeim, young, vibrant for the most part, young, very vibrant, very caring, and very, very much interested in your success. That's really what they want. This one does it his way, this one does it his way. But you have the opportunity of the century. This is probably the very best place to be if you're looking for people that really care about you. And that is a tremendous opportunity to take advantage of. And I hope that you will, and I hope that you will grow and become great. And I hope that in the process of becoming great, you will make the rest of Klal Yisrael that much greater as well. Hatzlocha.